and I just learned the best spell of all.
What's that?
Sleep.
Welcome back to My Alchemical Bromance. This is Eric Arneson, and I'm joined today by Robert Bonomo, who is a writer. He writes novels and he blogs. He's a tarot reader, and he's a documentarian. He just recently released his tarot documentary called The 21 Faces of God at the end of July. Hi, Robert. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing? Great to be on the show.
Oh, I'm doing great. It's super hot here, as I was just explaining to you, but I think it's just going to make me dumber, which hopefully will make my questions better. So, tell us a little bit about your documentary.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I wrote a novel based on the structure of the tarot.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Your Love Incomplete. So I really got, well, this is actually more like 8 years ago. So I really got into the structure of the major arcana. I used it as a narrative arc for the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got deeper and deeper into the idea of the tarot as a story, as a journey, I just got deeper and deeper into it. And so there, I came to a point where I thought, should I write a book or should I make a documentary? And there are so many tarot books. And the truth is, I think people today are much more engaged with video. So I took a shot at it. I had been in film school many, many years ago at NYU. So I did spend a year in film school. So I thought, you know, I should get my money's worth and let's see if I can make a documentary. But I wanted to make a documentary that really, you got the feel of each card, of the archetype embedded in them. And that's what I tried to transmit in the documentary, which is a little bit of background and then the arc. And I really wanted the viewer to get that feel of what happens when you go through the whole path of the major arcana.
Well, I have to say, I think you did a good job. One of the things that I came away with, so like you said, you start out with sort of a history and sort of a basic knowledge, and then you really get into the cards. And one of the things that I came away with a lot of the cards, I got kind of a new insight on some things. Sometimes I walked away thinking, oh, geez, this is just a whole new set of symbols for me to pay attention to with this card. So, you know, for me, like, I've got a lot of tarot experience, and it's always fascinating seeing how another tarot reader, another tarot person has interpreted the cards and how they've internalized them. Because I think that happens a lot. Like, no two tarot people are going to come back with exactly the same interpretation. You know, we'll have broad similarities, but not really specific similarities. The first time I responded to you after you sent me the link, I was like, oh, I just got through watching the section on the Hierophant and there are no words. And I was just sort of like, what's going on? And, you know, I mean, it was super impressive and it was fascinating. It was a fascinating switch because you were so dialed in and precise for a few of the cards. And then all of a sudden the Hierophant is just sort of like, I'm not going to tell you anything. Just have feelings.
Yeah.
I liked that a lot. You know, and you use that technique for a few other cards. And then some of them, I think maybe it was the High Priestess of the Moon or something of that nature. You spend a lot of time with just the imagery. So the whole time I'm sort of thinking like, oh, no, it's going to be another one of those ones where I just have to like sit with my feelings. And then right near the end, you start talking about it. And I'm like,
all right.
So the way that you used imagery created this great like emotional roller coaster as you went through the major arcana, which fits so well with how the tarot is supposed to influence people. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, and you know, as readers, that's why, because we both do readings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a feeling that comes. It's something, it's hard to describe. It's, you know, when divination works, it doesn't always work. But when the question is a real dilemma,
mm-hmm.
and the cards begin to speak, I mean, it's scary sometimes. They're so powerful. So that's why I thought a documentary would actually be more useful than a book, because, you know, a lot of data and keywords and mm-hmm. you got to feel the cards. You got to feel them. You have to, it's like music.
Oh, sure.
You have to feel the music.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and I really like that aspect of it, particularly because you spend, I don't know, between 5 and 10 minutes on each card.
Yep.
So it's possible to, you know, watch it all in one long sitting. I think I did it in like 2 nights, but it's possible to just watch the Major Arcana in one sitting and just go through the whole, you know, emotional ride or the whole symbolic ride, or it's possible to sort of break it up into little pieces. And I suppose one of the things that I was reminded of, you know, because when you read for other people, and even when you do like tarot contemplation, or if you're mm-hmm. like meditating on an individual card or something, it's really rare that anybody takes the time to actually sit down and work through the entire Fool's Journey like you did. So sort of taking a step back and going on that journey and seeing not only like all of these cards that I had a familiar attachment to, but hearing your take on it was really fascinating. And I'm just wondering, which one of those cards, like if you could go back and be like, this card was the easiest one to interpret, which do you think is your easy card, your easy card to figure out?
The Empress.
The Empress.
I hope it came across that. I mean, it was, and I'm a big fan of Kieslowski because uh-huh. I'm also a writer, and you know, in Kieslowski for me, I think, you know, all of us, we have those sort of artists that really impact us when we're in our 20s. Mm-hmm. That make a big, that. And for me, he's just, you know, so I knew that I was going to end with that last scene in Red. And the Empress really flowed, but she fought me in the editing. When I was editing it, she was like fighting back.
Yeah, I remember I liked that aspect of the Empress. Like you, so for me, a lot of the times when I look at the Empress card, it's a sort of like a mother card or a nurturing card. But you really latched on to sort of the more of the kind of like feminine beauty aspect of it, I think.
Yeah.
I liked that. So here's another thing that I was really fascinated by was your breaking up of the tarot into the triangle.
Right. That was key, I thought.
Yeah. So it was the material, the mental, and the spiritual. Were that those the three sides?
Right. Yeah, exactly. We come down the material, we go through the psychic, mm-hmm. and then we go back up the spiritual.
Yeah, I liked that. I thought that was really fascinating. I was, there's a few cards in there that, you know, I mean, it's interesting. Like for me, I guess, as I study tarot, there will be certain cards that I kind of like really dial in on and I spend a lot of time with, but I don't always go back and like reintegrate it into the whole Fool's Path, which I think is really important. And your documentary has inspired me to go back and do. So were there cards like, so if the Empress was the easiest, what was the hardest?
Well, I had a lot of trouble with the Fool.
Okay, that's good.
Because, and here's what happened. I did the first 5 sections. So there's an introduction, then I go into the history. Oh, mm-hmm. and history. I had, well, yeah, but you mentioned the card. So I did the history, then archetypes, duality, and then the structure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I got stuck. And I got stuck for a couple months.
On the floor.
And finally, oh my God, I didn't know what to do. So I was reading Emma Young's book on the Grail.
Uh-huh.
And I knew she was going to play a role. And then I saw a video by Lewis Hyde, who does a lot of work on the trickster.
Uh-huh.
And then it hit me. The Fool is a fusion of Parsifal. And also the Grail legend and the timing of when the Major Arcana emerged, there's a nice timing element there. They come out pretty close. No, the Major Arcana a few hundred years later, but still, it's yeah. that...
It's the same part that of the moment. World. You sort of tied it together through the Cathars and the Cathar heresy right. sort of stuff. Yeah, I found that to be really interesting, especially the timing of the Cathars and the Grail legend, because they were very contemporary.
Very. I mean, the Grail and the Cathars were extremely contemporary.
Can you talk about the Cathars a little bit, just so our readers, or I guess listeners, sure. so our listeners can catch up and know who they are?
Okay, yeah, this is a. I'm sure that your listeners are familiar with Gnosticism.
I would hope so. If not, then I'll just go drive to each one of their houses and slap them around a little bit.
Yeah, that. But you know, they can go to. But I'm sure they are. I don't think we have to.
Yeah.
So there was a now the tie back to the Gnostics in Alexandria to the Cathars is a little tenuous.
Yeah.
But the Cathars were basically a Gnostic sect that emerged in northern Italy in around. Oh, I think it's like the 10th, 11th century. They begin to emerge in northern Italy. And then they expand through southern France and become a very important force against the church. Now, these Gnostics, they basically deny the crucifixion. So they do not believe in a crucifixion of Christ or the glorification of Christ as a sacrifice.
Okay.
Christ for them is not a sacrifice, a debt being paid. It's a transcendent archetype.
Which they had in common with some of the Alexandrian Gnostic beliefs, right? There was a whole line there who was like, you know, Christ, it didn't even matter if Christ was a physical person. Christ's experience is like a map for us to follow to reach divinity or return to that ascendant state.
Exactly. Now the Gnostics, so they rejected the Old Testament, the Cathars. I'm pretty sure that they completely rejected the Old Testament. It's interesting too, they had you could be a Gnostic and then you could be a perfecti. Those were like kind of like the Gnostic priests. And they were both men and women.
Oh,
cool. Now, it's not clear exactly if the roles were identical, but perfecti could be men or women. Okay. They were against all sexual relations. They rejected the material world.
Dualists. That's why they always,
exactly. Okay. That's why they always call them dualists. And I think you see that in my film. There's a lot of that duality. That's why the duality in the tarot was so key. And in the Cathars, it's really important. So the perfecti actually had no sexual relations, didn't eat meat. I think they ate fish, but they didn't eat meat. And so then the church, it's a long story, but basically there was the Albigensian Crusade that wiped them out. Hundreds of thousands were killed. You know the phrase, kill them all, let God sort them out?
Yeah.
That comes from the Albigensian Crusade.
I think I've heard that before. Yeah.
The yellow cross, remember the Nazis made Jews wear a yellow
Star of David.
Star of David.
Yeah.
The origin of that came from the Cathars, who were obligated to wear a yellow cross to identify them as Cathars. So that's the origin of that. And they were finally all wiped out. The last group were wiped out at Montsegur. Oh my God, the dates, I'm kind of bad with dates, but we're talking about like 1235.
Yeah. 13th century, I think. Yeah. I think it was before they wiped out the Templars.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Before the time. Now, the Templars and the Cathar and the Albigensian Crusade stayed back.
Yeah.
They didn't enter into it.
Good. That was one good thing they did.
Yeah. And so I have a personal story that we all have our personal myths. My last name is Bonomo, which means good man. Now, the Cathars never called themselves Cathars. They called themselves Bonomi, good people.
Oh, so you might have some Cathar relations back there somewhere.
Well, I mean, I'd love to make something like that up, no?
It would be a great personal mythical history.
But it is my personal myth.
Yeah.
And my family is Italian, and not only is my grandfather Bonomo, but his wife, my grandmother was Bonomi, which is good people. And the Cathars were tradespeople. I think they were weavers. Basically craftsmen. And my family kind of has that sort of that craftsman type element to it. So it's just a personal myth. I can't claim any Cathar heritage.
Oh, that's cool though. All right. And then like the Grail legend, I loved how you brought that into the Fool card. Actually, I thought that was very inspired. So I'm glad that occurred to you. And the Grail myth itself, I remember you really honed in on the part of the Grail myth where they don't work on this as a group. They're like, each knight has to go off on his own and find the Grail on his own and have the quest on his own. Which I'm sure almost everybody out there has read at least a little bit of the King Arthur stuff and a little bit of the Grail legend, but each of the knights that goes off on the, on the quest has their own sort of trials and tribulations, and all of them fail, except for, what, Galahad, I think? And all in their own interesting ways, and some of them in horrible, tragic ways, and some of them sort of sad, and some of them just sort of come back saying, well, I'm too lazy to do this grail shit. So it's a fascinating way to look at the Fool's Journey, because, like, so much of the Fool's Journey is facing obstacles. Like, first, like, obstacles within yourself, and then obstacles within your own mind, and then obstacles dealing with your interaction with sort of like the universe as a whole. Like, there's a million places to stumble, a million roadblocks to come up with, or 21 roadblocks to come up against, I guess.
So I do want to give credit to Stefan Heller.
Okay.
Do you know Stefan Heller?
Oh, yeah.
I adore Stefan Heller, and I learned lots about the tarot from him. And I would recommend folks who are maybe just beginning, you go to, I think it's gnosis.org.
And, yeah.
There's a set of tarot lectures. It's like $20. It's well worth it.
Okay.
He is an extremely knowledgeable man. And he gave me a lot of the ideas, especially about that triangle.
Okay.
That triangle, a lot of that came from his talks.
Yeah. Stefan Heller, he's the Gnostic priest, right? Like, he's, yeah.
Right.
I actually just recently read one of his books. I thought it was pretty good. So, all right, well, I jumped right into the major arcana stuff without kind of like going back and talking about like the history of tarot, which I thought you gave a really, so when you first contacted me and you sent me the link, I was totally, I don't have a whole lot of patience for YouTube videos sometimes. So I was totally ready to like start it and be like, if he starts off with ancient Egypt, I've just turned this off. And you started off with image was ancient Egypt. And I was just like, I was so ready. And then you're like, tarot's not from ancient Egypt. I was like, oh, hold on a second. So it was really great that you had this really intelligent, I thought it was a very intelligent, honest look at the origins of tarot. And that's something that, you know, across the occult world, I feel like it's getting a little bit better these days, but our inability to appreciate the beauty of the past that we can actually, you know, point a finger at instead of just making stuff up. So I really, really enjoyed that sort of look at it, because you laid the groundwork for saying, like, I'm not going to go off into, you know, woo-woo land.
Land.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
I just want to say I made a real effort in this film mm-hmm. to stay away from woo-woo, because the cards deserve better. They deserve better.
They do. And I think, you know, you were spot on when you kind of started looking at, like, when they really started to blossom as part of the Western mystery tradition was in the 19th century, and that's really where. You know, I mean, a lot of our modern take on the Western mystery tradition still is rooted in like 19th century thought. So there's like the psychological model, which you spend a lot of time talking about, I think is like perfect for tarot's symbolism. So you did spend a lot of time you touched a lot on Jung and the archetypes and how they tie into tarot. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Did Jung ever write about the tarot?
You know, there are quotes of Jung about the tarot, but I could never verify them.
Oh, yeah?
So I didn't use them. There's some quote on the internet, but I've never been able to verify it. I don't, as far as I know, he didn't. Are you aware of any?
No.
Actual direct?
I'm not. however, I'm not really widely read in Jung. I haven't read a ton of Jung's stuff. I've read some of the stuff he wrote about alchemy and some of the stuff. I've got a book called The Gnostic Jung that has a collection of, you know, because he had one of the mm-hmm. Gnostic Gospels.
Right.
So I've read a lot of stuff related to him and a lot of stuff around him. And I've read a lot of Israel Regardi. And Regardi was pretty big on Jung. But and I have a friend who's a Jungian psychoanalyst.
Really?
Well, he's working towards it. He's a PhD student right now. But I personally haven't read a lot of it. So I'm just wondering.
Okay.
But Jung, so Jung sort of came about or like he really started coming into his own and becoming well known a little bit after Waite and Smith published the tarot deck, like maybe like a decade or something. So this concept of archetypal images and archetypal, you know, forms sort of existing in everybody was something that the Golden Dawn people had already been mm-hmm. playing around with, even if they didn't have the right words for it.
Oh, yeah. But we should go back because the idea of archetypes is really Platonic.
Yeah.
So, and Plato is really, you know, if you go into Plato, under Plato, there's Pythagoras. So when we just talk about idealist philosophy in general,
mm-hmm.
So I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say that, you know, Jung discovered the archetypes. He identified them in a way,
right,
and put them in a psychological context that made it much easier. Because, you know, when you read Plato, sometimes it's not so easy. But Jung put it in a way that you can understand them. No, I love Plato, and I think Plato is very readable. People should read Plato, but
mm-hmm.
sometimes Jung made it a little bit more understandable.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes when you read Plato, you can see that some of it's almost like a stream of consciousness stuff. Like he doesn't totally know what the heck he's writing about, which is kind of why it makes it so difficult to get. And you see it, like you totally can see it over and over again in how Plato is reinterpreted and rediscovered and reworked through, you know, Neoplatonists throughout the ages. And I'm not sure. So do you think then that the archetypes are a good fit, or like, do you think that they are the same thing as like the forms?
For me, they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it as a continuation. Now, I'm not a philosopher, so, you know, a serious philosopher could maybe give you a better answer. But in my feeling,
mm-hmm.
and I've read a lot of Jung, basically everything. I've read a lot of Plato. I've taken courses on Plato. So I see that connection. And idealist philosophy, obviously, Jung, I mean, if you look at, it's kind of interesting. If you look at Aristotle and Plato, and mm-hmm. you look at Jung and Freud, you know, you see that same dynamic going on and on, no?
Yeah, I guess so. Except I think it might be reversed, right? Because Jung sort of, his ideas grew out of Freud's. Or maybe alongside Freud's or a little later, you know, but Aristotle would be, I think, the Freud equivalent. And he was
right. And he was the student. Right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's backwards. He was the student. And yeah. You're right. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, I think academia loved Freud. I don't think they love him so much anymore.
Yeah.
And Jung was always considered a little bit too woo-woo, no?
Absolutely.
And Jung was never, yeah, people have to understand this, Jung was never a scientist,
mm-hmm.
though he tried to be a scientist. But he was so smart that he knew the only way he could get his ideas into the mainstream was presenting them as psychology. Psychology is as woo-woo as astrology, and it's all based on astrology. If you really understand Freud and you understand astrology, all Freud did was lift this stuff up from, you know, Mars, the id. I mean, come on, you know?
Yeah.
The superego is Saturn. I mean, it's clearly the connection is there. But Freud was smart, too. He's like, I'm not going to talk about astrology. Jung, remember, the end of the 19th century, scientism was just at its peak.
Mm-hmm.
Worse than now. So they went anti-woo-woo. But Jung was a mystic and a Gnostic.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Book. And look how the Red Book, he waited. Jung was brilliant. He waited to have that published to what, 2011?
Oh, yeah. He made sure it was long after he was dead.
And I know there was a note somewhere that said, wait 100 years or wait 90 years.
Oh, yeah.
And this stuff will, people will reach, well, they'll see it not, they won't call me a nut. And.
Well, in a way, it's kind of a good gamble because if, after he died, his ideas like faded into obscurity and nobody remembered him, then nobody would care when the Red Book was published.
Exactly.
But yeah, if true. He managed to stay influential and the Red Book comes out, then everybody has to stop and be like, oh, wait, we've been paying attention to this guy for so long. And now it turns out that everything was weirder. It's almost like It's almost like the experience we have with Newton, and you know, people hate. I think that scientists are probably more. They've come to terms with a little bit more now, but when it was first revealed that Newton had written millions of words about alchemy, you know, and was obsessed with like the structure of King Solomon's temple as like a, you know, metaphysical map of creation or whatever. Like, and so I think, and I haven't actually confirmed this in any of Newton's writings, but apparently for a while he was afraid to talk about gravity because he was like, all of my science buddies are going to look at this and say that I'm proposing action at a distance, which is magic, which they will hate. And we still can't figure out gravity.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, what about dark matter and, you
know. Oh man, I don't know. I don't want to make like wild claims about dark matter, but you know, when you hear it described, when you hear it talked about, like a form of matter that somehow influences everything like gravity but can't interact with us, that's freaky. That's too freaky. I don't get it.
I listened to a lecture from a NASA investigator or researcher, and he began it about dark energy. And I love the way he began it. He said, you know, what you guys know, understand about dark energy is about, just about what I know.
Yeah.
No, he was really honest. He's like, look, it's a placeholder. I think dark energy and dark matter are placeholders because there's a problem in the math. Eventually, I think hopefully it will come out. But it's just a placeholder. I mean, I mean, I'm 50 years old. When in the 1980s, if you read like popular physics, everyone was like, "Oh, we're about, you know, the unified theory. We're almost there." And then they find out that the universe is expanding at accelerating rate, and everyone's like, "Uh-oh, 92% of what's out there, we know what the heck it is."
You know? So, yeah. I mean, I studied physics in college in the 90s, and I was getting, you know, I was focusing on particle physics, and now, or quantum physics or something, I don't know, that was 20-some years ago, but I go back and revisit it every once in a while now, and I'm like, shit, everything I studied in college is wrong now? Like, what the hell?
Oh, wow, so you actually studied physics, so you understand this. It does seem like there's a lot of confusion in the physics world today, isn't there?
There is, and there has been for a while, and there has been... I mean, actually, there always has been. You know, we keep figuring some stuff out. It keeps being more confused in another way. The history of physics itself is really interesting to look into because you can see... I mean, it'll make you realize that the next time some doofus says to you that science is a religion, it's totally okay to just, like, walk away and be like, okay, this guy's too dumb to talk to. Because... You know, I mean, there's a scientism, right? Like, there are people who don't study science who just are going to trust in science or whatever. But science itself, like the real hardcore nerds who are down in the trenches doing the math and doing the observations and doing all of the stuff, they revel in their ignorance. Like, they are like, they want to find the edges of their own ignorance and push it and push it and push it until it breaks. And you can see it. So, Einstein's specific relativity, or maybe general relativity, I can't remember which one is which, but he broke Newton's equations, or he found places where Newton's equations weren't working, and so we had to change them. So even now, like, you learn Newton's equations, they're a great way to like estimate stuff and see how things work and see how the calculus is important and all that kind of stuff. But then it turns out that if you're going too fast, something changes. Things stretch in weird ways. Time changes. Space changes. So I think that you might be right. I think that might be a good insight that like dark energy and dark matter might be something wrong in Newton's equations, even with the relativity stuff added in. And again, I might be completely off, but it wouldn't surprise me if in another 50 or 100 years, we get another Einstein coming through who's like, oh, wait, it's not dark matter. It's blobbity, blobbity, blah. And here's one more variable that we stick in there and look, it works now.
And I'm no expert on this at all, but I'm just, I just like to read popular physics. And I listened to a lecture from the Royal Society. I believe he was Danish or Dutch physicist, talking about maybe the problem is our conception of gravity is wrong. And his theory went too far for me. I got lost. But in one part of it that I understood, that was kind of his premise. So maybe that could be, at play.
I think that really could be the case. I try to, so there's a great YouTube series, PBS Spacetime.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I watch that all the time.
I love watching that too. I'm lost, through the whole thing. And then he gets to the end where he's lost. Like, oh, I had this listener question, and he says the question, and I'm like, who the hell is listening to this? Are these all just physics PhDs sitting in their living rooms with bongs? And they're like, oh, dude, what if the star was like... most of the time I'm totally lost, but I love knowing that there are people who think that way and are working in that kind of stuff and figuring that kind of stuff out.
And it's humbling. Yeah. It's good for me because it really humbles me when I watch. I'm like, woo-hoo. Yeah.
Well, I feel like one of the best things in life is finding out you don't know something, reaching that place where you're like, oh shit, here's a whole realm of stuff that I don't understand. And sometimes it's stuff that you'll never get to explore, and sometimes it's stuff that you'll never get to understand or have the opportunity to understand. But recognizing your own, recognizing the places that you have left to explore, I think is the most exciting.
And the fact that your paradigms will change.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the first time is difficult. The first time is rough. But when it all breaks... And then you kind of build a second one, but it's temporary. Yeah. It's a placeholder. And then when it breaks, you're not so heartbroken. You're like, all right, I was wrong. Whatever.
Yeah.
But as long as you're making progress, becoming more conscious, it's all good.
Yeah, until you discover that you haven't been becoming more conscious, and that part breaks too. Yeah.
Oh, God. Now I'm going to jump out the window, man. You gotta get a little out of something.
let's tie this back around to tarot, right? Because that sort of path that you go on is built into that triangle model that you have, right? So, working through the material stuff,
and the tower. Remember, in the tower. Yeah,
the tower, everything comes apart.
How did that connect or not? I was just curious, because that's a tough one, the tower there. So I used the Fight Club.
Yeah, I liked the Fight Club. Yeah, because we do have a couple of really great. So you use Fight Club a lot, and you use The Matrix a lot, and I think both of those are some really good movies that have entered popular consciousness in a way where we there's at least an awareness out there that things aren't what they seem, and that you're not the only person who feels that way, right? So, and I think those two movies really frame that well. So I loved your use of that, and I thought I hadn't even thought about using that for the tower. And I kind of feel like, all right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about my feelings about the tower. Mm-hmm. First of all, I am going to reevaluate some of my interpretations of the Major Arcana after watching your movie. So there is some stuff that I'm going to have to look at again. But I've always sort of looked at the tower and the Hanged Man as being closely related. So the Hanged Man, which is number 12, is, in my feeling or my interpretation, is usually looked at as an initiatory experience, and maybe like a major initiatory experience, that you enter into voluntarily or willingly, or as like part of like a seeking quest where you're like, I need this knowledge, I'm diving into this. And I sort of always use as a, like, probably the perfect, I don't know, archetypal or mythological example would be Odin hanging from Yggdrasil. His whole thing is Odin goes on this quest for a long time where he knows that sometime in the future everything's going to go to hell, kind of literally, and everything's going to be bad, and he has to figure out how to stop it. He has to figure out how to see it coming and predict it and prevent it. And one of the things that he does in his quest is he learns magic. through hanging himself upside down from Yggdrasil for like 9 days or something. And he dies, goes through the underworld, returns with knowledge of writing and magic. And so I always sort of look at the Hanged Man as sort of like the symbol of Odin, where the Querent knows that there's something that they have to do. They know it's going to be difficult, and it's an initiation that they enter into willingly. And then the Tower, I look at as something very similar, but it's an initiation that you don't know you need that is thrust upon you. Yep. So it's sort of something that is not entirely in your control. So maybe if you're looking at that scene from the Fight Club from Helena Bonham Carter's point of view, where she's like, holy shit, what the hell did I wander into? Holy shit, what the hell is going on? Holy shit, everything is changing all of a sudden. It might be that she's experiencing the Tower card more than Edward Norton is. Although he's had an experience of his own in that scene too. Does that see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and you know, it's great to talk to another, because I just want to say, you know, my film is it's kind of personal in a sense.
Oh, right? Yeah, yeah.
If I had, you know, I was not that familiar. I mean, I know who Odin is and things, but I was not exactly familiar with that story.
Mm-hmm.
If I had known that story, I probably would have used it. But for me, mm-hmm. the Hanged Man, I think it's so similar
mm-hmm.
that your it's the beginning of the initiation, and what comes after is death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's interesting that it fits fits the card so well.
Mm-hmm.
That myth, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I think it really does. And I guess I also think, like, you know, having the Hanged Man followed by death fits into that initiation map that is so common in mystery schools. You know, so many mystery schools include right. a symbolic death as part of initiation. But it's safe, you know, it's a safe symbolic death. So it's still something that you're doing, you know, voluntarily. It's still something that you're, you know, entering into on your own free will. And then once you've started, you know, the initiation is just the beginning of the transformation. So once you've started, the transformation takes on a life of its own. And you kind of have some stuff just, you know, running away with you after that for a little while, which I think the Tower is a great symbol for.
Well, just one question. When you saw the film, did you see the relevance of Building 7 and then the reconstruction?
Oh, you know,
Building 7, I show it collapse 3 times. Mm-hmm. I go through the alchemic process.
Okay.
And then you see Liberty Tower. That's Liberty Tower at the end.
Oh, so I did not know that. I didn't know what Liberty Tower looked like.
Ah, okay, okay. Yeah, because I try and loop in the that whole thing of the towers collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
Two collapse and one rises.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the alchemic idea of we go in, you burn, mm-hmm. and then something new arises. But that's non-dual. It's not two towers, it's one.
Yeah, actually, that is an interesting piece of symbolism, because it fits, you know, I mean, the alchemical symbolism itself, you know, the almost all alchemy involves, like, destroying things with fire, like breaking stuff
right,
down.
With fire.
Mm-hmm. And then having something new come out of it, you know, the symbol of the phoenix
And the Fight Club did come out in 1998, I believe, 1998-99. The same time as The Matrix, no?
Oh, that was so long ago. Doesn't that make you feel old sometimes?
Oh my god. I know. I used to show The Matrix. I was a teacher in China at a university, and I would show the students The Matrix, and they're like, "Oh, this is one of those really old movies." I'm like, "Oh my god."
You're like, it's not Casablanca.
I know, exactly. I'm like, Casablanca's old. This is not old.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, all right. And then, like, you had so back to the material leg. You have the four, I guess I usually think of it as, like, the four authority figures, right?
The two aspects of the female and the two aspects of the male.
Yeah, so you've got, High Priestess, Hierophant, Emperor, and Empress. But not in that order. I just did that out of order. But
Right.
I was wondering, so I liked your take on it. So I find, like, a lot of those cards are actually some of the more difficult ones for me to interpret. Can you mm-hmm. sort of All right. First of all, the correct order that they go in is High Priestess, Empress, Emperor, Hierophant. So right. You have like the female spiritual authority, the female secular authority, the male secular authority, and then the male spiritual authority.
Yeah, you can see it on that on one level. But let's just do one thing. Let me just run through those first eight cards.
Okay.
Real quickly.
All right.
The Fool is, now the title of the film is The 21 Faces of God, not The 22 Faces of God.
Yeah.
And, you know, why is that? Because The Fool, and this is actually historical, The Fool is not considered part of the major arcana. So when you played the actual game, The Fool was kind of in between the pips and the major arcana. So The Fool is us.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to the magician, who's the alchemist, and he gets broken up. No? Right. Dissolution. The first stage of alchemy into four parts. Two that are masculine and two that are feminine. The two feminine parts, which would be the High Priestess, which is the moon related to the feminine knowing, that feminine kind of intuition. And then the Empress, which is the outer feminine, the material feminine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Those are the two feminine. Then on the masculine, you get the Emperor, which is fire, which is the active masculine. And then you get the passive masculine and the Hierophant, which is air, which is thinking. That's why in that part I use music.
Got it.
Because
music is
number, and that's order. Then when they get to the lovers, those four are brought together.
Mm-hmm.
So the four become one. And then in the chariot, you get the Fool gets on the chariot and he goes.
Mm-hmm.
So he's broken up. We're shown the four parts. Then he gets on the chariot and begins the psychic level. So that first part, I think, is very, very, it's very clear, I think, that how that works.
Yeah, yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. So the lover would indicate the union of the opposites, like whole set of opposites.
Become two.
And then
those two, those are the two horses. The male and the female and the lovers become the two horses.
Right, right. And then you interpret the horses as sort of the spiritual and the physical, or the need to remain in the material and the need to pursue like the divine side. Yeah.
And the chariot, and this I'm almost sure on. Now, I'm not an academic or a historian of the card, so I want to make that clear. No, there are people who are.
Yeah.
But I think it's very clear that the chariot comes from Plato's allegory of the chariot. I think it's very clear that is where the chariot comes. So that whole and I got that actually from I was taking a class on the Republic, and the professor started to talk about that. And I was like, oh my God, that's the chariot. And then I was listening to Joseph Campbell has at the end of one of his talks, he does a little rundown on the cards. I don't know if you've ever heard it.
No.
I can send you the file. It's fabulous.
Okay.
And he looks at that card. He'd never looked at the cards before.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at it and he goes, this is obviously from Plato's Allegory of the Chariot, with the one horse that wants to go to heaven, the other horse that wants to go to hell, or goes to earth. And you have to make that ride. But the gods get two immortal horses, so they just go around and around and around. And so I think that's pretty clear, I think, that the chariot comes from Plato's allegory of the chariot.
Oh, yeah, that totally makes sense. I'm again reminded of some stuff in mythology, like all over mythology in pretty much all of the Western world, and even in Egypt, you have gods in chariots riding across the sky or riding through the worlds or doing all that sort of stuff. Sometimes it does make sense. Like one of the Norse goddesses, maybe Frigg, I don't remember, but her chariot is pulled by house cats. She probably doesn't get anywhere.
House cats, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All right, so let's skip ahead to the last leg, the Celestials. Yeah, I love that. You know, some of my favorite cards are in there. Some of the scariest cards, like the Tower, you know, is in there. The Moon, which There was something that I was waiting for you to address in the moon that I'm not sure you touched on as much as I usually do, and I'm talking about it, but I always look at the moon as representing almost like the collective unconscious, or sometimes the shadow, like in Jungian terms, where the moon is sort of having to come to terms with the dark part of you.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's a great point. But I think you would see more of the shadow in the devil.
Yeah, that could be.
In the moon card is when you, in Jungian terms, your shadow is something that you reject.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not you. It's part of you that is so dark that you can't accept it, so you project it.
I always thought. Well, I guess maybe I got that wrong. I thought that part of the Jungian path is to see the shadow and accept it and integrate it. Is that
right? Right. But first, this is why. Like, where's your shadow? Do you ever meet somebody and you really just detest them?
Oh yeah,
it's just like immediate.
I guess that has
nine times out of ten, mm-hmm. what you're seeing is your shadow.
Oh yeah.
No, I mean, there are obviously people who are you just obviously don't like for normal reasons. Mm-hmm. But there are some people, it's like strange. Like, why do I dislike this person so much?
Because you see yourself in them.
And you gotta go, oh, expletive, you know. Don't tell me. I mean, that's happened to me 1,000 times. No. And then you go home and you're like, oh my God. That's when you see the shadow, and when you begin to integrate it in the individuation process, that's more where I see the moon. You're beginning to integrate that animal, that weird, goofy-looking lobster, mm-hmm. is becoming part of you. It's kind of emerging.
And that would also be the wild dog versus the tame dog.
Right. Okay. Right.
That makes sense. I like that.
And the two towers in the back, and you go through.
Right.
And she's dropping that dew on them, you know?
Yeah. So I don't know if you've ever paid attention to the Hebrew stuff in the cards. You didn't really mention it in your documentary.
I am not. I think that in the major arcana, mm-hmm. my personal feeling, that was an enormous mistake of the Golden Dawn.
Well, actually, there's this quote that I've pulled out of Arthur Edward Waite that I've tweeted a few times, where he actually said, like, if you're looking for somebody who thinks that attributing the Hebrew letters to the tarot cards is a good idea, it's not me. So even Waite wasn't big on it. But there's still some really interesting Hebrew integrated into the artwork that he did. And
oh yeah, definitely. Definitely.
One of them is in the moon card. The dewdrops are the Hebrew letter Yod, which is basically one of the names of God. It's like a divine symbol almost. I don't totally know what it's supposed to mean, but that's an interesting thing to think about. All right, so I'm gonna spend some time thinking about your interpretation of the moon. I think that makes a lot more sense than the way I was looking at it. And then next we have the star. Wait, the star comes before the moon.
No, you go right after the tower, you get to the star and then the moon.
Yeah, and I enjoy
the star. Star was probably the most difficult after the fool, mm-hmm. probably the most difficult. I banged my head against many walls on that one.
You know, the star is possibly one of my favorite cards. Like, I always feel good when I get the star in a reading. I always have an interesting time interpreting it. But it is also so difficult to explain to people. Like, because in a way, the star, you know, I always sort of like try to define the star as something kind of like divine inspiration, or there's no easy way to explain it. But I did like how, you know, when you were talking about it, the thing that I'm remembering the most, I think, from the video is how at the end you're sort of like, oh, and that bird in the background on the tree is the symbol of like the soul ascending, or the soul ascending to heaven, or to divinity, I suppose. And I liked that a lot. I was like, oh, you know, people usually ignore that bird. So yeah, I could see why you would find the star difficult to explain. That's a
And in making this film, there are some cards that, like the Tower, I always had really pretty clear idea what the Tower was, but the Star was always a bit of an enigma for me. And she, I feel like she really opened up because I really worked hard on that. The idea, then it's a very Gnostic card, a very Gnostic card. You go from the seven and the eight pointed star and the seven pointed star. That comes from the Gnostic idea of, you know, the seven planet, the planets. And then the eight is always the zodiac.
Right. The celestial sphere, right. Yeah. It's the Ogdoad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for example, Robert Place's book on this, I think he does a really good job of talking about the Lady of the Apocalypse, how she's tied into this, because that's definitely there. And then the Gnostic Sophia. And then I found that really that quote from Irenaeus, which I kind of liked, where Sophia is not exactly John the Baptist, but a little bit. It's kind of like she snuck in there. And I love that because I'm very Gnostic in my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And Gnosticism, I would say for me in the cards, the key elements I would put are the Grail, Gnosticism, and alchemy. And I did not understand alchemy. It took me a long time to really connect to it. And once I did, I would say that, you know, it's probably one of the best and clearest ways to
look at the cards.
You know, and to look at life,
and
to look at the cards. And now in the history section, I try, because I didn't want to go woo-woo, but I show a lot of alchemic images next to early images of the cards, and I put the dates there. I think there's a clear influence. Whoever made the first, or came out with, say, the, what's the name of the first Italian deck, the Visconti deck.
Oh yeah, yeah. They saw deck, some of that.
They were familiar with those alchemic images, and they're embedded. I don't want to say embedded, but there at least there's an influence there.
Oh yeah.
Remember what Jung said about alchemy. Jung loved the Gnostics. Mm-hmm. He thought that was the key, I think, cosmology for him. But Gnostic cosmology is crazy. You know, the Pleroma and all these people, it makes, you know, for modern people, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Oh man, the Archons.
Alchemy and modern.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And the Archons, and then this Archon, and then they have 15 daughters, and then it can get a little confusing.
Yeah, for sure.
Alchemy is Gnosticism for the modern mind. That's what Jung said. When Jung saw that bridge between Gnosticism and alchemy, and it's an important moment in his life because are you familiar with Marie-Louise von Franz, who worked with Jung?
No.
Okay, so Jung had, well, just a quick story. So Jung's married, but he had lots of girlfriends. And one of his what's her name? Oh, I can't remember his first lover's name. So he had like a second wife. When Jung realized that he had to focus on alchemy, that's when Marie-Louise von Franz moves into his circle, and he completely focuses on alchemy. Jung is convinced that the individuation process is the alchemic process. For Jung, it's absolutely clear. And that's why I really bang the drum on Jung.
Okay.
And Joseph Campbell, because Joseph Campbell is really kind of a neo-Jungian a little bit. Very much influenced by Jung, let's say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a lot in here that I'm going to have to sort of like take away and spend some time with to kind of like integrate it into my own tarot practice. So this was really, really helpful to me. The documentary was great, and the documentary was totally like, I got to sit and think about this for a while. But actually, like, getting a chance to ask you these questions about it, I think has been really great. There's a lot of stuff to go back to. But I think that's probably a good amount for our listeners to digest as well.
Maybe a little bit too much.
Why don't you tell them where they can find you on the internet, or where they can find, and especially where they can find the movie. I mean, I'm going to link to it in the show notes so that people can see it for sure. But just let them know.
Sure. If you go to YouTube and just put in the 21 Faces of God, it should pop up. You'll see my YouTube channel, and that's all there is on there. It's just the film.
Okay.
So there are two, the film, I have two parts. I have the long form version, which is 2 hours and 48 minutes. It's pretty long. Mm-hmm. And then I have the serialized version into 27 parts.
Yeah. I watched the serialized version and I thought that was pretty good because it gave you a chance to sort of like stop at logical points and think about things.
And maybe Google some stuff, you know, if you want to, what is this? What is that? Yeah. So however, you know, if you're really brave and you want to, you know, try the long form. If you want the serialized versions, they're both there. They're both there. And if I could just ask folks, if they do enjoy it, if they could go to Rotten Tomatoes and just Google the film, it'll come up on Rotten Tomatoes. And if they can show it some love there, that'd be great.
That is a good idea. I will put a link to that in the show notes too, so that they can vote for you quickly and easily.
Great. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure to talk to you about this stuff, and it was great to get to nerd out about tarot with somebody who's had tons of experience and a different take on stuff. So
thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll send people your way and we should keep in touch. Like maybe we can do a follow-up after a while, after you've had some more feedback from stuff. And so we'll have you on again.
That'd be fantastic.
All right. Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
My Alchemical Bromance is sponsored by Miskatonic Books. Miskatonic Books is an online bookstore that focuses on rare, limited edition, and custom-made books of the highest quality. They specialize in books on the occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, Hermeticism, and other topics of interest to you, our listeners. Check them out on the web at miskatonicbooks.com. I'm not going to be able to do that.